KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. We asked the Department of Homeland Security second in command about how they justify the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil and whether the administration will have immigration reforms or just enforcement. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Also coming up, Iran rejects President Trump's call for talks over its nuclear program. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The country's supreme leader says he will not be bullied by America into making a deal. Also, how after the pandemic, we've gotten better at hunting diseases and whether all four members of a K-pop supergroup can find success going solo. It's Thursday, March 13th, an auspicious day for astronomers. Uranus was discovered today in 1781. Pluto's discovery was announced in 1930. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. officials are in Moscow discussing a potential ceasefire with Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine has signed on to this, but a top advisor to Russian President Putin is dismissing a potential 30-day truce. The advisor says a ceasefire is just a break for Ukrainian troops. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Putin has already made strong demands.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says four Ukrainian regions officially annexed in a Russian referendum 2 years ago must be handed over. Never mind that Russia doesn't completely control them on the ground. Samuel Cherup is an analyst of Russia at the RAND Corporation. He says it's not likely Putin will get the entirety of the regions of Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson.
You can expect Russia to come in with initial positions that are quite maximalist, but ultimately the territorial control is going to be determined by the battlefield and not at the negotiating table.
He says the regions will likely be frozen with neither side recognizing the other's claims. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Trump administration is moving ahead with its decision to fire about half of the staff at the U.S. Department of Education. President Trump says the best employees will be kept on at the agency. But NPR's Corey Turner says a review shows hundreds of people are being fired in groups.
I am right now looking at a spreadsheet of nearly 1,000 Education Department employees who were fired and the jobs they did. And these layoffs were the opposite of a thoughtful case-by-case, person-by-person thinning based on past performance. They cut people in large groups with nothing in common but the kind of work that they were doing. Again, civil rights enforcement, education research.
NPR's Corey Turner reporting. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows drug overdose deaths in the U.S. continue to drop at an unprecedented pace. NPR's Brian Mann reports the latest data show roughly 30,000 fewer people are dying per year.
According to the CDC, roughly 84,000 people are dying every 12 months from overdoses. That's still a lot, but it's a huge drop from the peak in 2023, when fentanyl and other drugs killed more than 114,000 people in the U.S. Many states are now seeing drug deaths decline by more than 30%, with North Carolina and Virginia experiencing 40% fewer deaths compared with just a year earlier. CDC researchers call the improvement unprecedented. There's a debate underway over what caused this massive public health success. One theory is the Biden administration helped ease the fentanyl crisis by making the medication naloxone, also known as Narcan, far more widely available. The easy-to-use nasal spray reverses most fentanyl overdoses. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A Senate committee has canceled the confirmation hearing for President Trump's nominee to run the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The panel says former Florida Congressman Dave Weldon's nomination is withdrawn. A person familiar with the matter tells NPR Weldon did not have the votes to be confirmed in the Senate. Two candidates campaigning for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court held a debate last night. The judicial election will determine whether liberals or conservatives hold the majority on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. From member station WUWM, Chuck Quirnbach reports the candidates sparred over how much money billionaire Elon Musk has poured into one of the candidates' races.
Two groups funded by Elon Musk have spent more than $10 million supporting judicial candidate Brad Schimmel, a circuit judge and former Republican state attorney general. Schimmel's opponent, Circuit Judge Susan Crawford, told a debate at Marquette University that Musk has basically taken over Schimmel's campaign.
He's got paid canvassers who are knocking on doors, handing out flyers that say, support the Trump agenda.
Schimmel replied,
If President Trump or anyone defies Wisconsin law and I end up with a case in front of me, I'll hold them accountable as I would anybody.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court election is April 1st. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
Forecasters say California is getting a powerful atmospheric river. It's pouring heavy precipitation across the state. The eastern California mountains will get feet of snow. Lower levels could get flooding. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Sammy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump has ramped up efforts to deliver on a campaign promise to carry out the largest ever deportation of migrants without legal status in U.S. history. Parallel to that effort is a crackdown on what the administration terms anti-Semitism on college campuses. Last weekend, a former student protest leader was arrested in New York City. Mahmoud Khalil, who has lawful permanent residency, a so-called green card, is being held in a Louisiana detention center. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, says his green card was revoked. A judge ordered that he may not be deported, though, while the court weighs a legal challenge brought by his lawyers. Troy Edgar was just sworn in as Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and he is with us now to talk more about this. Good morning. Congratulations on your confirmation and also your return to the department. You served in the first Trump administration as well.
Yeah, good morning, Michelle. Very nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So Mahmoud Khalil says he acted as a spokesperson for pro-Palestinian demonstrators and as a mediator with Columbia University, where he was a graduate student. As you know, Mr. Edgar, any conduct that can be legally sanctioned must be described. So what is the specific conduct the government alleges that Mr. Khalil engaged in that merits removal from the United States?
Yeah, I think what you saw there is you've got somebody that has come into the country on a visa, and as he's going through the process of that visa process, he's come in to basically be the a student that is not going to be supporting terrorism. So, you know, the issue is, you know, he was let into the country on this visa. He has been promoting this anti-Semitism activity at the university, and at this point, the State Department has revoked his visa for supporting that terrorist-type organization, and we're the enforcing agency, so we've come in to basically arrest him.
Okay, so a White House official told the Free Press that there's no allegation that he broke any law. So again, I have to ask, what specifically constitutes terrorist activity that he was supporting? What exactly do you say he did?
Well, like I said, when you apply for a visa, you go through the process to be able to say that, you're here on a student visa. It doesn't afford you all the rights of coming in and basically going through this process, agitating and supporting Hamas. So at this point, the Secretary of State and the State Department maintains the right to revoke the visa, and that's what they've done.
So what? How did he support Hamas? Exactly what did he do?
Well, I think you could see it on TV, right? It's this is somebody that we've invited and allowed the student to come into the country, and he's put himself in the middle of the process of basically pro-Palestinian activity. And at this point, like I said, the Secretary of State can review his visa process at any point and revoke it.
Forgive me, he's a permanent resident. He's not a visa holder. He's a legal permanent resident. He has the green card, at least he did, until it's alleged that it was revoked. So look, if the allegation is that Mr. Khalil organized protests and made speeches, after which other people engaged in prohibited activity or, say, violent activity, well, Mr. Trump gave a political speech on January 6, 2021, after which some individuals engaged in violent and illegal acts. How is this any different?
Yeah, well, like I said, I mean, President Trump's the citizen and the president of the United States. This is a person that came in under a visa. And again, the Secretary of State at any point can take a look and evaluate that visa and decide if they want to revoke it. And
he's a legal permanent resident. I have to keep insisting on it. He is a legal permanent resident. So what is the standard? Is any criticism of the Israeli government a deportable offense?
I think that at this point, when he was entered into the country on a student visa, at any point we can go through and evaluate what his status is, and the Secretary of State
is any criticism of the United States government a deportable offense?
Like I said, if you go through the process and you're a student and you're here on a visa and you go through at any point,
is any criticism of the government a deportable offense?
It's like I said, as a student, he comes to the United States on a student visa, applies. Well, let me put it this way, Michelle. Imagine if he came in and filled out the form and said, I want a student visa. They asked him, what are you going to do here? And
he said, well, he was
I'm
a
going
student.
To go and protest and
so
join
is protest
an anti-Semitic
a deportable
activity.
Event?
We
is,
would never have let him into the country.
Is protesting a deportable offense?
Like I said, you're focused on protesting. I'm focused on this visa process. He went through a legal process, came into the country.
Are you saying that he lied on his application? He's a lawful permanent resident married to an American citizen.
Well, I think if he would have declared he's a terrorist, we would have never let him in.
And what did he engage in that constitutes terrorist activity?
I mean, Michelle, have you watched it on TV? It's pretty clear.
No, it isn't. Well, explain it to those of us who have not, or perhaps others have not. What exactly did he do?
Well, I think it's clear, or we shouldn't be talking about it. I mean, the reality is that if you watch and see what he's done on the university,
do you not know? Are you telling us that you're not aware? You don't know what he did?
No, I find it interesting that you're not aware.
I think you could explain it to us. I think others would like to know exactly what the offenses are, what the propaganda was that you allege, what the activity was that you allege. Well, perhaps we can talk again and you can give us more details about this. And that's Department of Homeland Security Deputy Secretary Troy Edgar. Mr. Edgar, we really appreciate your coming to join us, and we do hope we'll talk again.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is moving to dismantle decades of key environmental and climate rules and policies.
That announcement came yesterday in what Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin called the most consequential day of deregulation in U.S. history, rolling back more than two dozen regulations. Environmental groups predict this will lead to a future with more pollution.
Jeff Brady from NPR's Climate Desk is here to tell us more about this. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Michelle.
So which regulations are being targeted?
You know, probably the most significant is something called the endangerment finding. In 2009, the EPA determined that human-caused greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that are heating up the planet, those endanger public health and welfare. This decision was years in the making. Litigation that led to it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and now it's the basis for many of the country's climate regulations. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin put out a video statement that suggests he thinks it's not constitutional.
I've been told the endangerment finding is considered the holy grail of the climate change religion. For me, the U.S. Constitution and the laws of this nation will be strictly interpreted and followed. No exceptions.
What are some of the other regulations the EPA is reconsidering?
Zeldin said the agency will reconsider rules that limit climate pollution from power plants and from cars and trucks, also regulations that limit soot and mercury in the air, other rules that Zeldin claims are hurting the economy and costing trillions of dollars. But that leaves out the fact that pollution also costs the country, you know, in health costs and cleanup. It's not clear whether EPA plans to get rid of these rules or weaken them. Those details should come later.
And what are environmental groups saying about this?
You know, this is even more dramatic than what they expected, and certainly more aggressive than the policies Trump pursued during his first administration. One group, the Environmental Integrity Project, said the EPA is driving, quote, a dagger straight into the heart of public health. I talked with Matthew Tejada at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He called this an all-out assault on the law, science, and the administrative part of the government that keeps people safe.
They're going to roll these things back. And they're going to take our country back to a time when rivers caught on fire and kids couldn't go outside without seizing up from an asthma attack.
Just as the country is making this big transition from fossil fuels that are heating the planet to cleaner energy, Tejada says the Trump administration is tying the country to oil and gas for another century.
And what about the oil industry? How's the oil industry responding to this EPA announcement?
Well, they're pretty happy. The American Petroleum Institute said voters picked Trump for cheaper energy, and now his administration is answering that call. And much of this fits with API's policy priorities. And we've already seen some of the biggest oil and gas companies reorient themselves from climate change concerns and back to fossil fuels.
And Jeff, before we let you go, what are the next steps here?
There just aren't many details in this announcement, but just that the EPA is going to reconsider these regulations. So assuming the typical process is followed, we should see some proposed rules, then comment periods before final rules. But, you know, environmental groups already say court challenges are coming.
That's Jeff Brady with NPR's Climate Desk. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
The next generation of scientists is already asking big questions and providing solutions.
Yeah, high schoolers Mateo Paz and Ava Cummings were honored at this year's Regeneron Science Talent Search. That's America's oldest science and math competition. Paz took first place with his research on detecting objects in the night sky.
I have a catalog of 2 million objects around. 1.5 million of them are new candidate discoveries.
Paz designed algorithms to sort through 10 years' worth of data. His results help catalog and identify black holes, supernovas, and star systems. And his work is already being used.
There genuinely are a lot of use cases for what I found here. And that's really why I'm excited about this. For example, a prototype of this catalog is already in use by a separate research group at Caltech, trying to analyze these things called M-dwarfs, which can actually help us understand which exoplanets can actually be habitable for humans like us.
Second place winner Ava Cummings used fruit flies to create a model for STAC3 disorder. That's a muscle disease that currently has no cure, first found in members of the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina.
It has a lot of connections to my cultural background. And so I was just very interested in doing some more research into this disease and also introducing some novel treatments that might help improve the quality of life for individuals within my tribe that have experienced this.
Cummings found that the combination of the experimental drug tirasemtiv and an herbal treatment made from nettles produced the best results.
It led me to value how the bridge between modern medicine and then traditional indigenous medicinal practices can be very applicable in the scientific community and in medicine.
Both students intend to pursue their passions in college, paving the way for the future of scientific discovery, and it sounds like they both are well on their way. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the South African playwright Ethel Fugard, whose plays, including Master Harold and the Boys, were about the emotional and psychological consequences of apartheid. And we also remember songwriter and singer Jerry Butler, who sang with Curtis Mayfield in The Impressions before going solo. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From USPS. USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We're going to zoom in on this next story. Actually, zoom way in. A team of scientists looking at a microscopic mystery recently won a top prize from the publisher of the journal Science. Reporter Ari Daniel has more on their discovery and how it might revolutionize farming.
Starting in the late 90s, John Zare, a now retired microbial ecologist from UC Santa Cruz, was confronted with a puzzle. On research cruises, while testing seawater, he and his colleagues kept finding the same fragment of DNA in the ocean. But when they went to look for the organism it came from, no one ever managed to see it.
Every time we would get these samples, we look through the microscope and there's nothing there.
And yet the DNA was everywhere, in the open ocean, along the coast, in the tropics, the Arctic. It also appeared to have a special and rare function of taking nitrogen from the surroundings, which living things need to survive, and turning it into a form that could then be fashioned into proteins and DNA. Usable nitrogen like this is pretty scarce.
That's why we added as fertilizer in agriculture. The same is true in the oceans. It's in short supply over wide regions of the ocean.
Up until now, the ability to transform nitrogen was a feat scientists thought only certain kinds of bacteria and other simple microbes could pull off. But here's what this puzzle wound up revealing. Some 140 million years ago, a free-living bacteria that could grab all the nitrogen it wanted out of the water it was swimming in fused with an ancient algal cell, says Tyler Cole, a biologist with UC Santa Cruz.
One cell engulfs another and then doesn't digest it, but rather incorporates it into its own body.
Over time, the bacteria jettisoned some of its genes. The algae became dependent on the nitrogen it was receiving, until eventually each one could no longer live without the other.
So the process of two species becoming one.
This is a lot like what gave rise to the mitochondria and chloroplast, but in this case, it led to a cellular structure that could transform nitrogen into something useful. The researchers called it the nitroplast, and it's responsible for pumping significant amounts of nitrogen into the global ocean. Solving this microscopic riddle took years. The first clue was that whatever had produced this fragment of DNA was missing all sorts of genes. To survive, Zare figured it had to be getting help from another life form.
Because it lives with somebody else who can provide those things.
He was right. That somebody else turned out to be a kind of single-celled algae that looks like a teensy soccer ball. The team partnered with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to use X-rays to peer inside that soccer ball. Structural biologist Valentina Loconte was struck by what she saw.
Inside the alga, I found a little cell.
This little entity, what appeared at the time to be a little cell, was the oddball source of all that DNA in the ocean.
It means that the two organisms are really living together.
Tyler Cole pored over the inner workings of both. He found the little guy's missing genes were housed in the big cell, and the big cell received nitrogen from the little guy. That is, the two needed one another.
And at that point, it makes it very difficult to call these two different organisms if their genomes are so intermingled.
Instead, this was a single organism. The little guy was actually the nitroplast, a component of the bigger algal cell. This nitroplast allowed the more complex organism, so not a simple microbe, it had a nucleus, to capture its own nitrogen.
It's been in plain sight, but to get the details that finally made the leap of faith, wow, that's really cool.
Doug Capone is a biological oceanographer at the University of Southern California who wasn't involved with the discovery. He says the nitroplast could be introduced someday to crops to allow them to convert their own nitrogen without relying on external fertilizer.
This provides a model system for how one might integrate the nitroplast into an agriculturally important crop.
It's one of the holy grails of biotechnology, says John Zare, the ability to engineer plants that could snatch nitrogen out of the air and use it to grow without any of the pollution, energy, or expense that current fertilizers require. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
One of the biggest K-pop girl groups, Blackpink, is no stranger to the Billboard charts, but all four members now have their own solo albums and are hoping to chart at the same time. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has more.
Blackpink has been quiet for a little while now in order to allow its members a bit of space to launch solo projects. This week, Lisa entered Billboard's main albums chart at number 7 with her new record, Alter Ego. Lisa also made waves in the TV and movie worlds in recent weeks. She appears on the new season of HBO's The White Lotus, and she performed the Wings song Live and Let Die on the Academy Awards telecast earlier this month. But of all the Blackpink solo projects, so far Rosé has found the widest success in the US. Her album Rosie hit number 3 in December. It spawned the colossal hit Apaté, that's her earworm with Bruno Mars that's been on the charts for months now. Another Blackpink member, Jennie, is set to hit next week's Billboard chart. Her album Ruby dropped last Friday. You're gonna feel this every day. This that pretty girl mantra, this that flaunt, you just touched down in LA. Pretty girls don't do drama unless we wanna, it'll be depending on the day. Like Lisa, Jennie has worked as an actress. She turned up in the misbegotten HBO series The Idol a couple years ago. Finally, Jisoo has been slower to take off in the US than her Blackpink cohorts, though her recent digital-only release, Amortage, will get a boost with a physical album this Friday. Even with all this solo success, the women of Blackpink are still banded together. They're set to kick off a world tour in July. Between them, the inevitable return of BTS, and upcoming releases by other groups, K-pop promises to be one of the biggest stories in music this year. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
After the pandemic shut schools, Louisiana educators said no time to lose getting students on the right track.
When you say let's wait a year, what you're really saying is it's okay to let these kids suffer another 365 days.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How Louisiana became the only state since the pandemic where students got better at reading. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
President Trump says he is ready to slap a 200% tariff on alcohol from the European Union unless the EU drops its 50% tariff on U.S. goods slated to start in April. Trump issued the warning in a post on Truth Social, escalating a trade war the U.S. has with multiple trading partners. In Canada, Dan Karpinchuk reports Ontario Premier Doug Ford is meeting with U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick in Washington to try to bring down the temperature.
Ford says he paused the surcharge to let cooler heads prevail. It came after President Trump threatened to bump the 25% on Canadian steel and aluminum to 50%. Ford, along with Canada's finance minister, will meet with Lutnick. He says their message is, quote, "Let's stop this. It's hurting both economies. And let's move forward on what's needed to negotiate the USMCA."
Jeffrey Sonnenfeld is an associate dean at the Yale School of Management. He tells NPR many business executives are bracing for a possible recession.
Roughly 70% say the Trump administration is going to be bad for the economy, and they're very concerned.
President Trump's withdrawn Dr. Dave Weldon as his nominee for CDC director, a person familiar with the matter but not authorized to discuss it, says Weldon does not have the votes in the U.S. Senate, which cancel Weldon's confirmation hearing today. U.S. stocks trading lower with the Dow down more than 300 points. It's NPR News. In his new book, the Dalai Lama says his successor will be from outside China. NPR's Omkar Kandekar reports the spiritual leader previously said that the practice of having a spiritual head for Tibetan Buddhists could end with him.
In his new book, Voice for the Voiceless, the Dalai Lama has said his successor will be, quote, born in the free world. He also asked his followers not to recognize any candidate chosen by China. Tibetan Buddhists believe in their spiritual leader's reincarnation. The current Dalai Lama is believed to be the 14th in the line of spiritual leaders that date back to the 14th century. A spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry has said the Dalai Lama is a political exile and has no right to represent the Tibetan people. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
In China, several trade unions are warning companies to stop asking female applicants about their marital and or childbearing status. The privacy notices also urge employers to honor legal protections for women on their staff regarding health and leave. The unions addressed companies last week on the Chinese social media platform WeChat, coinciding with International Women's Day. Many women have said they've received conflicting messages from companies that prefer to hire single women with no plans of having children, and from the Chinese government, which has been urging women to wed and help reverse the declining national birth rate. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump sent a letter to Iran about opening new talks over its nuclear program.
But the president says he won't rule out military options either.
We're down to the final moments. We're at final moments. Can't let them have a nuclear weapon.
Joining us now to explain Iran's response and what's at stake here is NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Aya, good morning to you.
Good morning, Michelle.
So let's start with this letter. Trump has said the letter to Iran would be proposing nuclear talks to avert military action. So what can you tell us about Iran's response so far?
So this letter was delivered by a senior Emirati official from Abu Dhabi who traveled to Tehran and met with Iran's foreign minister yesterday. But before it was even read by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had this to say. So he's speaking to university students yesterday in televised remarks, saying the U.S. is trying to deceive global public opinion with this letter and that Iran is not ready to negotiate. And referring to Trump, he says this is the same person who tore up and threw out a signed agreement. Now, he's talking about Trump's decision in his first term as president to withdraw the U.S. from a nuclear deal that was reached under President Obama and included China, Russia, and European countries. That deal put caps on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting sanctions. So Khamenei says, how could one possibly negotiate with such a person? And he warned Iran can defend itself against threats.
Yeah, so he's referring here to what we call like Trump's maximum pressure campaign on Iran in his first term. And it did ramp up tensions in the region where you are. So what can you tell us about how things are, where things stand right now?
Well, despite Khamenei's sharp words, Michelle, Iran's mission to the United Nations struck a different tone, saying in a post on X that if the objective of negotiations is to address concerns about the potential of nuclear weapons, these discussions may be subject to consideration, but that Iran would not dismantle its peaceful nuclear program. And it's important to note here, Iran's position has been that its nuclear program is for peaceful energy purposes and that it's not interested in building a nuclear weapon. That said, since Trump scuttled the nuclear deal in 2018, Iran has been increasing its stockpile of enriched uranium, according to UN inspectors. The UK, France, and Germany have continued talks with Iran about its nuclear program. And tomorrow, China, Russia, and Iran are meeting in Beijing to discuss Iran's nuclear program and the sanctions that are crippling its economy.
And what is the view there from the Gulf Arab states like the UAE, which is where you are?
So the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, these Gulf Arab states are playing the role of mediator on many different files, whether that's on Iran or Ukraine or in Gaza. And so the reason they can do this, though, is because while they view the U.S. as the most important military superpower, it's not the only player on the block. They've kept warm relations with Russia, for example, and it was China, if you recall, that brokered the deal that repaired ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia a few years ago. So yes, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they want hard curbs on Iran's missile program and its nuclear ambitions, and they would like to see its Shia militias in the region wiped out. But they do not want a region on edge or the kind of attacks on oil targets in the Gulf that we saw under Trump's first term when tensions were soaring.
That is NPR's Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Aya, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
5 years ago this week, COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. And as the virus spread, it became apparent how little the world knew about protecting itself from a serious global outbreak. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports that since then, some things have gotten better, others have gotten worse.
Eric Carlson can tell you what's getting better. For years, he's been frustrated by how long it can take from when a disease first strikes to when scientists can identify it and respond.
A lot of times we're on the backfoot. We're finding things maybe a week or 2 weeks or even a month later.
Carlson is the director of the National Influenza Center of Cambodia. He says COVID highlighted this problem, and he spent the past few years working on how to get disease information in real time.
What we've done is really put together what we call kind of a lab in a suitcase.
Open it up and?
We have a laptop, we have a sequencer, a rice cooker that we use to make gels. We can actually unpack it and have it ready to test in about 5 minutes.
They've used it on poultry farms and plan to take it to wet markets and rural hospitals. One swab can test for multiple diseases.
Dengue plus chikungunya plus Zika plus Japanese encephalitis plus
COVID, flu, rabies, and he can get the genetic code. Is this human flu or avian flu or something entirely new?
Within 20 minutes, we're already understanding what viruses are in that sample. We are now ahead of the game.
Advances in disease surveillance are happening all over the world, including here in the U.S. Paul Friedrichs was a chief medical advisor for the military during COVID. He says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention deserve credit.
If you look at where they were in 2019 and where they are today, they've made huge improvements in their ability to see what's happening here in the United States.
They're doing things like sampling wastewater to see what diseases are circulating.
Collecting data automatically from electronic health records, from emergency rooms.
But Friedrich says all that data isn't valuable without this, the public's trust. In fact, that's his biggest concern when thinking about the next pandemic.
You can have the best surveillance system in the world. You can build the perfect test. And if you just walk out and say, I built the perfect test and people don't trust you, they're not going to use it. And then it doesn't matter if it was perfect.
A Pew Research study found that during COVID, more than a quarter of Americans said they didn't trust scientists to act in the public's best interest. And still today, that public trust remains below pre-pandemic levels. Luciana Borio says she understands why. Borio served in the first Trump White House as director for medical and biodefense preparedness. She says during COVID, patients told her they couldn't openly express their skepticism about things like vaccines and lockdowns.
Anybody opposing the prevailing views, they were kind of ostracized and not invited to the scientific debate.
Which, she says, made people more distrustful of health authorities. The pandemic also sowed distrust between countries. China didn't share relevant data on COVID. Many low- and middle-income countries watched as wealthier nations got COVID vaccines and medications first. One major effort to fix the issues that emerged is the pandemic treaty. But international negotiations have faltered. And then in January of this year, President Trump pulled out of the talks altogether. Lawrence Gosting at Georgetown Law thought now the whole thing is going to blow up, but it didn't.
In a perverse way, President Trump's withdrawal from the negotiations and from WHO has energized much of the rest of the world to get this done.
As the U.S. now sits on the sidelines, Gosting worries. If there isn't trust and cooperation between nations, he says, it's going to be much harder to protect ourselves in the next pandemic. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Experts say high school starts too early and affects students' health. Lawmakers in Florida wanted a later start time, but budget issues got in the way. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, May Martinez. All aboard the Dune Express. That's the name of the longest conveyor belt in America. It runs 42 miles across Texas and New Mexico, moving sand needed for fracking. In pictures, it really does look like an empty roller coaster in the middle of the desert. Environmentalists say this will make it easier to drill and cause more pollution. But the company behind it says it avoids heavy trucks filled with sand from clogging highways, a danger for other drivers. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration's plan to shrink the federal government is targeting multiple civil rights efforts. At the Labor Department, a draft proposal would nearly dismantle an office that investigates discrimination by federal contractors. NPR's Andrea Hsu looks at what this could mean for workers, and here is where I want to let you know that this report includes descriptions of sexual assault.
Unless you're a company that does work for the federal government, you've likely never heard of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs. Its primary role has been enforcing an executive order signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1965 at the height of the Civil Rights era. It required most federal contractors to take steps to ensure women and people of color have the same opportunities as others, that there aren't barriers to employment or to promotions.
Not all companies are willing to look under the hood voluntarily to see whether they have a problem.
Jenny Yang oversaw this work at the Labor Department during the Biden administration. She notes federal contractors employ a whopping 20% of the U.S. workforce. So the old executive order has been a big deal. It's given rise to groups like Chicago Women in Trades, whose mission is getting women in the door. For decades, they've trained women to become plumbers, electricians, pipe fitters, sheet metal workers. In recent years, the group has worked hard to meet what's expected to be a construction boom, with billions of new dollars approved for federal infrastructure projects. Jane Valinga is the group's executive director.
We have doubled our programs, we've doubled our staff, we've really tried to meet this moment.
At the heart of this, she says, is ensuring women have a path to good-paying middle-class jobs. In Chicago, a union carpenter earns $55 an hour. But now this progress is threatened. Trump revoked Johnson's executive order on his second day in office. Lauren Sugarman, now Valinga's colleague at Chicago Women in Trades, is mourning its end.
It is a huge loss, what's happening now.
In 1980, Sugarman was enrolled in a vocational program aimed at getting more women and African Americans into the steel mills. Then an industrial giant came calling, a well-known company that had won a federal contract to maintain and repair elevators for the Chicago Housing Authority. Under Johnson's executive order, the company had to at least try to recruit women. Sugarman calls her interview.
I always call it a disinterview. It was basically, you don't want this job is too dirty for you, this job is too dangerous for a girl, you really won't like it.
She took the job anyway. It was hard work, and she did encounter problems. Sugarman says men grabbed her breasts and made rape jokes in packed elevators. But she stuck with the company for 6 years, eventually working on other projects, including at Sears Tower.
There were 100 elevators and escalators in the building, and at that point it was the tallest building in the world.
Now she wonders if the small forays that women have made in the trades will simply vanish. The Labor Department did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Now, Jane Valinga will tell you, the 1965 executive order and the government's work to enforce it only went so far.
None of these things were fantastic. I want to be clear about that. There was more of an emphasis on checking boxes, but it was something.
Now she fears some federal contractors won't bother to consider women at all.
They are not civil rights organizations. They're builders. For how many people will this fall off the priority list?
Plenty of women have proven they can do the work and do it well, she says. But you can prove nothing if you can't get your foot in the door. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The year is 2035. A totalitarian United States run by an unpredictable and thin-skinned woman president is at war with a techno-authoritarian China. The war splits Taiwan in two, and a group of young people who meet in Hong Kong must each decide their role in the conflict. That's the plot of You Must Take Part in Revolution, a new graphic novel by journalist Melissa Chan and dissident artist Badiu Cao. The two have something in common. Neither can return to China because of their work critical of China's leadership and policies. They both join me now to discuss their new book. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. So, Melissa, where did this idea for the book come from?
I was staring at my collection of graphic novels from when I was a teen and thinking about the state of the world at that time. President Donald Trump had just lost the election. There was also the turmoil in Hong Kong in terms of the protests, the student protest. And I was born in Hong Kong. So there was a confluence of geopolitical events happening at the time. And I just thought I wanted to do something like this.
And Badiu Cao, how about you? Where did this come from for you?
Well, like Melissa mentioned, that the Hong Kong protest resonated in me very deeply. Thus, when the idea came to make a fictional graphic novel about the resistance, it's irresistible that I have to do it.
I want to get to the plot. I mean, as you both point out, it starts with the protests in Hong Kong and these young people who are pushing to keep their freedoms. But then it gets bigger and it takes on the U.S. and China's battle for supremacy in the world and Taiwan at the center and its quest for sovereignty. Without giving away too much, describe the type of power each of the governments deploys in the story.
It's really interesting. We know China is a techno-authoritarian power now. And I think we were sort of projecting and wanting to project what it would look like in the future.
Right, because it takes place between 2019 and 2035, which isn't too far in the future.
Yeah. You may recall then Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan and how much tension there was at the time. And we started looking at each other and wondering whether there would be a conflict between the United States and China even before our book came out.
Wow.
But there was a weird relationship between fact and fiction and the interplay of that.
As the book goes on, who is good and who is bad kind of gets murky as these two superpowers, the U.S. and China, fight over Taiwan. In the end, what is the message here?
It's an interesting collaboration between Badiu Cao and I, because Badiu Cao is an activist and I come from a journalistic background.
Yeah.
So what's been interesting in this process is that I think we might have different messages for the readers. When I look at protest movements around the world, you look at Hong Kong, but also in Thailand, in Myanmar, it looks as if taking to the streets isn't getting the kind of results that we used to see a few decades ago. And for me, it's a big open question in terms of how citizens hold their government to account and how citizens can also push for their government to become more democratic.
Hmm. What about you, Badiu Cao?
You know, artists is not really in the role to providing answers, but rather ask questions. Mm-hmm. I do hope that this story will reflect the direction of this world and be very blunt, particularly in the perspective of Chinese dissident artists that do not just seeing the problem is only in the Chinese government, but also seeing the decay of democracy in the West, particularly in America at this moment, and need to grow up, not relying on any certain force, but make our own choice and change by ourselves.
As an activist and artist, Badiu Cao, and as a journalist, Melissa, you've both been punished for your work. Badiu Cao, you do art that pokes fun at the Chinese president Xi Jinping, that uses satire to shine a light on human rights abuses in China. And Melissa, your journalist visa in China was revoked for the work you've done. And I see censorship as a through line in the novel as well. Is this drawing on your own experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that another reason for why I wanted to work on a graphic novel was that actually looking at DC and Marvel Comics, I felt like so many people writing about authoritarianism in the fantasy world were Americans who might not have necessarily experienced living and working in an authoritarian country. And so I thought that I did have something to bring to the table in terms of my personal experience of surveillance and working and operating in authoritarian governments.
For me as an artist, I just have to try different media and try different platforms. For my gallery practice, yes, the Chinese government will try their best to always ensure that my exhibition is canceled or the venue that holding my shows is harassed or under international repression. There's no guarantee that the space will be welcomed or safe.
Yeah.
But the method to defeat it is just keep trying new things.
Is this book a warning?
I do think the story carries bit of nature of warning because the similarity between the plot and what is going on in this world. But more than warning, I hope this work is a reminder of what happened in the history, like the Tiananmen massacre or the protests from Hong Kong. But more importantly, I hope this work will be a force of empowerment for the readers to realize that individuals are just not a powerless force in the society, that actually there is a lot of potential for individuals to make change in the scale of history if we believe our choices, if we act now.
Journalist Melissa Chan and artist Badiou Tso are the authors of the graphic novel You Must Take Part in Revolution. Thank you to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
Rock and roll like a rocking chair. Laugh and smile while